The sun has gone down at Hangman's Hill, and the ghost at Misery Corner isn't walking tonight. So, welcome to the Weird Tales Radio Show, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic, and folklore. And now, here's your host, writer, award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and sometime werewolf hunter, Charles Christian.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Weird Tales Radio Show with me, Charles Christian. We've another big interview this week, so rather than me chew the fat, we're going to jump straight in. My guest is best-selling author Freddie Silva, who is here to treat us to 1 hour of high strangeness as we discuss ancient mysteries, alternative history, sacred sites, ley lines, and crop circles. Freddie is the author of 6 books, including First Templar Nation, about the Knights Templar, The Missing Lands, Uncovering Earth's Pre-Flood Civilizations, and The Divine Blueprint, providing an account of the origin of ancient temples and the role played by sacred sites in raising human consciousness. Freddie has been described as the best metaphysical speaker in the world right now.
Good to be speaking to you. The first question we always like to ask is, what got you interested in writing about and researching these types of topics?
Probably because I was drawing pyramids when I was 3. I think we're all hardwired to do something in life. We don't really know it, or at least most of us are not aware of what we're here to do until much later. Some of them are very lucky, and they find it pretty early on, but I never really fit into the modern world. I still don't. And I sort of got sidetracked into going into graphic design. I tried to be a rock and roll star in London and America. Didn't quite succeed. And I had the hair back then as well. And then I became one of the youngest creative directors in advertising in London, moved to the States. And slowly I realized that my passion was elsewhere. I kept getting fired for having a conscience, and I figured I'm not really changing the world. So it was those moments during being laid off that I picked all the books that I'd accumulated in my library, and I realized, you know, this is what I want to do. I want to go and play with pyramids and Stonehenge and all kinds of things, and to find out what this is all really about, because I've never really accepted the official version of things. Something just isn't quite sit right. And it was that inquiring of mine that just led me to where I am today. But I really got through it through studying crop circles. And incredibly, my first book that I released ends up being an international bestseller. And it still is. I'm very proud of that. So the segue really was to find out that crop circles are done exactly in the same way as pyramids and Stonehenge and every other sacred site in the world. So it has been a very rich sort of research project for 25 years.
Yeah. The first book, was that Secrets of the Fields?
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So again, I know a lot of people have an interest in, and I'm using the term broadly, the paranormal as opposed to the, if you like, the mundane. But yours is got a very strong mathematical, geometrical angle to it. It's one of those things traditionally, isn't it? If you like the arts at school, then you usually hate maths and geometry in particular. But you're going there with the pyramids, the crop circles, the sacred geometry of sacred sites. You're also interested in the Templars. And again, there's a whole field of Templar geometry that I've seen reference to. What is the attraction of it? Is it the fact that all these lines just, they aren't random, they seem to mean something? Where did that angle come from?
Well, actually, it was what I tried to do is bring in a certain science to underpin all the metaphysical work that I tend to get involved writing about, because a lot of it is involved with metaphysics. It's to do with the alteration of the human spirit and the improvement of the human condition. And these things are thousands of years old. And one of the things that I really aim to do is to try to bring people who might be on the fence or even skeptical to take a look at this. Otherwise, I'm just preaching to the choir and nothing's really being moved. I should sort of point out, I actually hate mathematics. I don't see numbers easily. I have to actually draw pictures to understand numbers. And I forced myself to understand what the ancients were doing. And it turns out that in the 60s, the Russians were looking at exactly the same stuff. So to bring these two worlds together, when the Russians were hard up for money and the war was still up, they would go to Gothic cathedrals and they would try to understand why is it that people are having unusual spiritual experiences. And I don't mean religious experiences, sort of metaphysical experiences in these buildings, but they're also being healed. Is it something to do with the positioning and the arrangement of things inside the building? Well, it turns out they were absolutely right, that shape has a profound effect on the human body. Just like when you go into certain pyramids, they affect you different to other pyramids. And yet they're all pyramids. They all look the same, and yet they're not. The angles of the slopes are different. And that's the point of the matter, that the shape has a profound effect on the human body and its state of awareness. If you actually look at the human DNA under the microscope, you see that we're all made of a bunch of sugar crystals and amino acids, and they're all geometrically aligned. So like it or not, we are drawn to geometric order, and it's that geometry, the angles that move atoms and molecules in a certain way, which then have a corresponding effect on people, which is why you can go into two near identical temples and they'll have a completely different effect on you for that very reason. So that's why it got me interested into understanding what these people were doing. And it turns out there was a whole science behind it.
No, I'm taking your point because, yes, I have observed that you can go into some places, you know, an old church, and if you like, and it just appears to be completely soulless, for want of a better word. And you can go into others and there is just something moving about it, some element, something otherworldly about it.
Yeah, I mean, if you go to the oldest ones, the Celtic Christian church especially, and of course the Gothic cathedrals, the one thing that they share in common is that they were all built upon original temples, and every one of those temples all around the world, without exception, are built upon the crossing points of the Earth's Tuileries currents, which NASA only picked up only about 30 years ago. In fact, they even sent a press release out about it, saying that they're actually interested in looking at these geomagnetic anomalies and also these electromagnetic serpents, for lack of a better word, that crisscross the land everywhere. I mean, I'm sitting on one right now where I'm speaking to you from in Maine. And in fact, it's the only place where I can actually do my work and have my desk. So there's the connection. Ancient people were very much more connected to the lands. They could understand the subtlety of things, and they understood that sitting in certain locations, that something felt different, and that's where they felt, okay, this is where we're much more connected to the spirit of nature, what they called God back then. God was not a guy with a beard sitting on a throne. It was a spirit that surrounds every living organism. So for them to be in these hot spots where the Earth's telluric currents congregate, it was for them an easy way to, you know, disappear from this mortal coil for a few minutes or a few days. It became part of the fundamental concept of initiation. And they would connect with a kind of astral reference library. And then they would come back renewed, rejuvenated, and they would go on their daily lives much better than they were before. And as we stopped being able to see these things with the movement into industrialization, it turns out that the ancients thought, well, you know, humans are not going to do well out of this because they're becoming disconnected with the source. Let's build temples on top of these energy lines so we know where they can find these hotspots. And that's what the culture of temple making really developed from. It was from the understanding and harnessing these invisible forces which are around us every single day. We tend to ignore them at our peril, but now we know where to go find them, which is why there's a sudden drive around the world. And I've seen it in the last 20 years of people who really feel the need to go to these ancient places. And I'm not talking about mass tourism either. People really feel that there's a connection that they're missing, and they can find that connection in these temples.
And these telluric lines, are they the same as ley lines, or are they different aspects of the same thing?
You know, I get asked that a lot. I don't know how the two ever became connected. Ley lines was really a term that was coined by Alfred Watkins when he was looking at geometric alignments on the landscape in Herefordshire and then throughout the whole of the British Isles. And he was absolutely correct. There was an ancient system of metrology where the sites were connected by geometric alignments, especially if they held some kind of common point between them. You can't just draw the lines willy-nilly. Mm. That would be easy to do. It would be like connecting post boxes and figuring out, oh, there's a pattern here. No, they have to actually be part of the same function or the same age or the same shape in order to make the connections. But the different point is that the energy lines are something completely different. They are literally serpents, invisible serpents, that move all around the Earth. And sometimes where they interact, they create these eddies called blind springs, and that's where you'll find the world's biggest temples. So they're kind of interconnected, but they're not quite the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, is that really because Watkins' ideas got taken over by John Michell's view over Atlantis, which does tend to call them energy lines and dragon lines and sort of blurs the difference?
No, I think people just misunderstood what he was writing. I mean, he was actually one of my tutors, I guess. Incredible man. I think people just misunderstood the two, and somehow they got the two together without realizing that, first of all, you have the energy currents, the telluric currents, and then you put structures on top of them. And sometimes if you find that, say, three or more in a vicinity that are connected by age, shape, or form or function, if you connect them, it turns out that they actually form a straight line. So there's sometimes the two overlap, but they're not the same thing. I think I've just misunderstood what he was trying to describe.
What about, because we mentioned this at the very outset, crop circles? You know, that we're heading towards the summer season and there'll be more crop circle sightings. Now, I recall seeing stories about crop circles when I was a kid growing up in the 50s. And certainly the literature has tales of crop cycles going back to certainly the 17th century, if not earlier. But it all rather got hijacked again in the, 20 years ago, when it was all said it was all done by hoaxes and it was all lack of myth. What's your take on crop circles?
Oh, they've been around quite a long time. In fact, we gathered eyewitness accounts going back to the 1860s with policemen and postmen and farmers. They're quite fascinating. And they usually were accompanied by the same reports that there's usually a tube coming out of the sky in bright daylight. And this is from farmers, by the way, who are not into any of this stuff.
Yes.
So when they talk like this, you've got to be paying attention. And one of them from Sussex in 1963, if I remember the day correctly, or 23, I can't remember. He talks about how he was out in the barley field. It was a beautiful summer's day. And he said he called it a tube, just rotated out of the sky from the clouds, stopped a little bit short of the head of the crop, rotated it for about 15 seconds, which is the standard time I hear in every single account, regardless how big the design is. And then, boom, it just flattens. And in one case, there's a farmer also in Hampshire that talks about rain actually bouncing off this invisible tube. So he was looking at a kind of an eddy, a vortex that was coming out of the sky, and perhaps even more. But the whole thing has been, you're right, it has been completely hijacked, not by skeptics, but by people within MI6. And this is where the conspiracy theorists can start listening in, because the conspiracy is actually quite true. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist. We actually traced the stories of the hoaxers, who originally were Doug and Dave, back to MI6 as part of this information campaign, while the military and the government in Britain kept the phenomenon under watch. Well, if it was a big hoax, then why were they actually using our taxpayers' money to keep the whole crop circle phenomenon under observation? It didn't make any sense. And anybody who looks for the minutes of Parliament can actually look into this. So it turns out that they knew, the military also knew that there was a real phenomenon going on. The farmers always complained that the first sign of crop circles at 3 a.m. on their land were immediately preceded by military helicopters. We're bristling with high precision equipment, taking photographs, shooting videos, to which as many of the farmers would respond by going out and shooting guns into the air and getting rid of them. I love British farmers. They've got a sense of drama. So the whole thing really, I mean, and to this very day, we cannot reproduce as humans the real physiognomy of the crop circles, the lack of damage, the bend 2 inches above the soil, the changes in the center of the structure of the plants. All that cannot be done by people. And I've seen my fair share of people trying to make crop circles, and they're getting better at it, but they can't reproduce them. That's the big thing. And again, it goes back to the connection to ancient sacred sites. They also are appearing on the Earth's telluric currents, and they're also influencing the shape and structure of the energy of the local sacred sites wherever they happen to appear. So there seems to be a very big communication going on with the Earth and our ancient systems of knowledge, which is what got me very excited about the phenomenon, that A, it's being kept under control. Two, there's a massive program of disinformation. And by the way, up until the 2003, when I was researching this physically in England, there was a D-notice sent out to every single media department in Britain, which says that anything to do with crop circles had to first go through the ministry, MOD for clearance. Now, you only issue scheduled D notices to the media during times of warfare. Mm-hmm. Now, that sounds a bit drastic to you, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yes, indeed. Yeah.
And it should make everybody question the skeptical angle that often comes out in the media. And you should be very suspect of what comes out in the media regarding all crop circles being hoaxes. There's quite a fair amount of them that there are, especially today. I think the real phenomenon really has come and gone. I mean, there was a communication that really got going in the late 70s and kind of finished around 2002. And after that, I think since then I've probably seen half a dozen that are real. In fact, we get more of them here in America than we get back in Britain now. And we know where they appear. And we also keep very quiet about them because the farmers are a little bit fed up with having their fields trampled. And it's a very important piece of the communication. So far, we've extracted new mathematical theorems. We have new methods of propulsion that have been extracted from the designs, and they've been built in England, in Australia, and in America. And the rest I can't tell you about because I'm sworn to secrecy. People are just waiting for the right moment politically to bring out these new methods of propulsion, and they have to do with anti-gravity. So it's very exciting. This is why the military is very keen on understanding what's going on, but they never will. They haven't quite got the angle that we have.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think, what is your suggestion that causes crop circles? We're taking the view it's not the aliens, it's something...
Oh, it depends on your view of aliens.
I suppose so, yeah.
They're certainly not local. I mean, scientifically, it's the manipulation of the local geomagnetic field coupled with sound frequency, which is why the shapes look so sonorous. It's because it's the expression of sound frequency on the physical medium, such as, you know, crop or, you know, sorry, wheat, barley, and so forth. But at the behind it, there's a consciousness that's behind it. And we actually were able to communicate it on many levels. And it was very exciting. It's a very friendly, very loving consciousness. They're very real on their level of reality as we are on ours, but we can't really interact with them. It's like interacting, or it's like having a radio station at 88 FM and trying to reach 3 million FM. You're just not going to do it. But we knew about this before the modern phenomenon got underway through a woman in Wiltshire who actually works with the police solving murders. And she's one of the most gifted natural psychics I've ever met, a great friend of mine. And we had the transcripts that were coming through her. And at the time, we had no idea what this was going on about. They're talking about shapes in the fields near the Hill of Light, which was Silbury Hill, and within 7 Earth days of your time. And these shapes will be used to, first of all, alter and suggest a raise in human consciousness, to make the human population aware that we're in the middle of massive Earth changes before the idea of climate change even entered the conversation. And three, there would be symbols used to, and I quote, prevent the earth from turning over until humans have a chance to understand that they need to figure out what's going on, because we're in the middle of huge problems and we're not prepared. And the idea is to help us to become prepared for the big changes that are still ahead in the third decade of this century, by the way. So it's still not over. And we have a chance to overcome these things. And meanwhile, they would also be giving us new technology, blueprints in the actual designs, which have now, like I said before, have come true, and also healing modalities, which we also are applying as well. And they call themselves Watchers. And they said that if you look at us in your Earth history, you will be able to find evidence of our time when we're on the Earth, and we're very physical. And years later, as I've been researching temples and ancient civilizations, I've just wrote my current book, The Missing Lands, actually talked about them. And yes, they were here 12,000 years ago. They were part of a very old civilization that mostly went under during the flood. They survived in pockets. They became the gods that we know very well in Egypt, in Mesopotamia, South America, Central America, and elsewhere. They're the ones who helped us restart civilization after the world was destroyed 11,000 years ago by a big flood, for which we now have the geological evidence to back it up. So It's kind of funny that all of this was happening in the late 70s, early 80s, and we had no idea what they were talking about or who they were. But now, with all this research, we can actually validate that once, yes, they were very much physical, just like us. Or as to quote the line that I usually hear from indigenous people around the world, they were human-like, but not quite human. And they called them the sages and gods of old.
Yes, indeed. No, I've got about 19 different thoughts pinging through my head on that. So
it's a complex story. It's a very complex story. Yeah. I mean, you're talking about the manipulation, or should I say, I mean that in a positive way, the manipulation of thought as it travels through space and time to become shapes that we can see in reality in our physical dimension. We really are pushing the envelope of physics at this point. And in fact, it's kind of ironic, the physicists who have taken an interest in the crop circles have actually discovered that not only are they giving them new information about the way we see the world, but at one point, they actually gave us the second and third speed of light before we had even discovered that there was a second speed of light. This is what I'm talking about. Anyone who really wants to indulge and get be part of this phenomenon, there's something for everybody in it.
Your point about the Watchers and elder races, again, is one of those topics that crops up in so many human mythologies and societies that it doesn't matter where you are, there's some kind of not quite supermen, but as you say, like humans but different, who were around before. In a it's one of those universal phenomena, isn't it, as opposed to just to Western civilization, if you like.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Western civilization has been borrowing from these people forever. That was one of the things that I wanted to do when I was researching these people. I mean, talk about making life easy for myself. Let's find the people who are no longer alive, haven't been around for 12,000 years, and let's find out where they lived. And no one wrote anything about them. It required really listening to people on the opposite side of the world, very ancient people, who have a very distinct memory of these events. Because we've got to understand that myth and legend are theatrical devices which are written in this in a way that you will never forget the story. And they encode information which is very real. In many cases, it's astrological, astronomical, mathematical, and historical information. And it's written in a way that we never forget. Otherwise, if you just tell it as a normal story at the pub, yeah, a few years from now, the story will change and you're likely to forget it. But it's a dramatic way of making sure that you will never forget the story. The problem is it's written, it's so old, and these stories are so old that the vernacular tends to be kind of difficult, and we tend to dismiss it because we don't understand it. But if you sit with it for a while, be patient with it, keep slow down the syntax of the stories, they become very revealing, and they all have the same thing in common, like you said. I mean, these people were living a separate existence, a parallel society. They tried to keep themselves to themselves. They often lived on islands, which are now under the ocean. And only when they were forced by the rising sea levels after the flood did they have to really just hang out with humans and, you know, and tell us much of what they knew, because they were also dying too. There weren't many of them left. And it's kind of funny that around 8,500 BC, we all discovered civilization around the world spontaneously. Now, it was an amazing moment for hunter-gatherers. We all learned about mathematics and the stars and navigation and animal husbandry and crop rotation. And this is exactly the same time that the stories appear at specific spots around the world. And they describe them as very tall, usually about 8.5 feet tall, which is why we have, you know, thousands of giants' graves in Northern Europe. And there are lots of giant bones that were buried there. And, you know, they were made to go away and disappear, of course. And also they were kind of red-haired and green-eyed, blonde and blue-eyed, and always light skins. And when you hear that in the Pacific, you think, well, these people obviously didn't belong here. They came from somewhere else. And they were very much revered. They were not as sort of higher entities, but people who really understood how nature works, and they had complete control over the laws of nature. That also comes up in all the indigenous conversations. And, you know, we as hunter-gatherers back then were actually very appreciative and always welcomed them. In fact, I was just talking about an account in the Easter Islands, which dates back to 12,000 BC, of a people that no one's ever heard of called the Waitaha. They ended up being one of New Zealand's indigenous cultures thousands of years before the Maori. So you can guarantee that my book has been banned in that country for political reasons. But I've also made a lot of friends with the Waitaha who live there. And they're saying, well, thank you for bringing this to people's attention. And to which, of course, I say it's my absolute pleasure. And they were talking about how back before the flood, the gods used to come over from South America. They would speak with the tribal elders and they would give them information. They would take on water, food, and then they would say, bye-bye. We're off to sail our big double-hull canoe over to the birthplace of the gods, which, by the way, is a real place in the South Island of New Zealand. It's absolutely beautiful. And they were actually caught in the middle of the flood. They lost one of the ships. They took on survivors, and they eventually got there. And two generations later, they went back south of Easter Island because of the way the currents work to a place called Kainga Nui Nui, which is a massive island which also sank during the flood. So they had to keep going back to South America, where they already had established a temple city. And I thought, well, I wonder what they're talking about. And I found out during one of their oral traditions, they said, well, they used to take two totem birds with them as a sign of protection for the journey. One was called Titi and one was called Kaka. So, of course, that's Lei Titikaka. And there you will find one of the oldest temple cities on earth, Tiwanaku. And one of its middle temples is dated to about 15,000 BC. So, again, why would these people, if they were hunter-gatherers, make up such ludicrous stories? In fact, how could hunter-gatherers make up such ludicrous stories unless, of course, they were eyewitness accounts?
You're listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian.
Presumably, then, just jumping around, the lines that are seen in the desert in South America, the Nazca lines, are they related to this?
You know, that's a huge mystery, and I can't say anyone's come close to understanding it yet, and myself included. It's one of those things that keeps you chomping at the bit. I have looked at a lot of the astronomical calculations, and they do turn out to be true. I mean, these places are located in an intercardinal horizon, which does give you a certain element of horizontal features in which to project stars rising in and out of these outcrops. So this is not unusual in that part of the world. And the rest of it is a complete mystery. I mean, we've heard the story of Erik von Daniken. He thinks that they're landing places for ships. Well, the problem with that theory is that if you happen to go to Nazca and you walk around the lines, you recognize that these things are cut into the earth About 3 feet. I mean, you've removed the top layer of oxidized soil to reveal a lower layer, which is what gives them their lighter color. Mm-hmm. And even a bicycle driving through the desert will actually damage it. So I don't think that they're runways. As interesting the theory is, with all due respect to Eric, there are also other ones that talk about these petroglyphs being sort of messages to signal to the gods. And I'd say, well, that's actually quite true, because back in the day, when they said that these gods were associated with the stars, they came from the stars, they could travel at will, they have the means to get about the world, and also to connect them with the belt stars of Orion, which is something that comes up in every single culture. They talk about how these people were able to go backwards and forwards as easily as you and I go shopping for a can of baked beans. Mm-hmm. And to them, it wasn't a big deal. They said, well, they had the means, they could do it. And one way that they would communicate with them would be to replicate some kind of image to signal back to the gods as a kind of thank you. So those are some of the more elegant theories which seem to connect with the spirit of the legends and traditions of the local people. But we also have to understand that the Nazca lines come in various time frames, and they get worse and worse as they get closer to our time period. The best ones, the most elegant ones, are actually the oldest ones. So there is a lot of scribbling going on there that has been going on for thousands of years. But after that, I have to admit, it's still a complete mystery. So thank God for that. It gives us something else to work on.
Yes. Taking it, if you like, from the sublime to the sort of domestic, presumably this is, if you like, the basis of feng shui, organizing houses, you know, it's a sort of domestic sacred geometry. Would that be right in...
Oh, it's absolutely right. Yes, it's all of this really goes down to improving the human condition. The fact that we incarnate here as a soul, we're trapped in this limited vessel made of flesh and bone, and we tend to forget why we came here or what it is that we're doing here. And the whole purpose of all of these teachings really go back to a kind of mystery school that spans the world over, about how to make it easier for yourself to understand your relationship to nature, yourself, and the cosmos. And when you do that, you become as a god. That was the term that was used. And you become godlike. You become a form of nature because you're working with nature. You're no longer separate, which is one thing that religion is so good at doing, keeping us separate from the creative force. And all of these methods and teachings are really used to try and connect you to that source. And it's funny that you brought this up, because I just came back from Sedona, where I taught a couple of temple-making classes. Well, after years of going to the temples and making tons of notes and writing books, I've finally worked out that, wait a minute, this is all very practical. Just because these things are very old and some of them are a bit disheveled doesn't mean that they're no longer functioning. And I was able to figure out that every temple around the world is based on seven principles. And I thought, well, I wonder if we can reproduce these in my living room. And if we can do that, then I can teach these things. And my God, yes, it does work. You can build a temple in your living room and make it very, very subtle. So you're moving energy lines, you're using geometry, you're using specific types of stone and crystal. Because if you look at the temples around the world, they didn't just pick the local rock. They would go sometimes 400 miles to get the exact rock. And you ask questions, well, why that rock and not others? Well, it's the type of quartz, it's the type of iron, the magnetite in the stone. And when you put these in the laboratory setting, they do some very interesting things. They become piezoelectric and also the conductive. And you can also, now with the power of human intent and the measurement that we've undertaken in laboratories, to measure the ability of human intents to alter the outcome of, say, machines. There's a famous experiment in Princeton that was done about 40 years ago, where 22 people sat in a room and the intent was to alter a computerized drum beat, and they succeeded. Now, imagine the power of a human body to be able to throw a packet of electromagnetic information at a desired object and affect its outcome. That's big stuff. And that's exactly what this technology was all about. And I refer to it as a kind of spiritual technology, because when you put telluric currents, magnetic energy, stone, geometry, sacred measure, and and also orientation has a lot to do with it as well. The way it faces specific stars and also specific points of the compass. When you put these things together, you're creating this layer caking, and then be careful what you ask for because you might get it. It really does thin the veil between worlds quite considerably. And then you're in a state of grace when you sit in these places. So you can recreate this technology wherever you live, in your home or in a garden or somewhere. I know people that actually did this in Britain. There's a massive 10-point star which connects Glastonbury, Stonehenge, and 8 other sites all the way through the southwest of England. And it really shapes the kind of feel of that location. The same thing was done in Wiltshire with a lot of the tumuli. And most of them, there's no one buried in these tumuli. They're just mounds marking these energy currents. And when you know which ones you're looking at and you connect them, they turn out to actually mirror entire constellations. And this is done all over the world. So the idea was to create these spaces that allow you to become much greater than the sum of your parts. It was all to do with raising your awareness so you can live your life really fully aware. It's nothing really new under the sun. I think we're still doing it today.
I was just thinking what one of the points you were making there with the tumuli and the materials being brought great distances, because that is one of those things that, you know, there's still been investigations over Stonehenge, you know, why bring the stone all the way they did from South Wales to that location. Again, you get that with medieval cathedral building, that the stone is often brought great distances when there would have been ample building materials available elsewhere and closer to hand. So, right, that's a little sort of piece of the jigsaw puzzle falling into place on that.
Exactly. Yeah, when things stand out of the ordinary, you've got to ask questions. And once you, that's the funny thing with the work I do. I've noticed over the years, now that I kind of feel like I know what I'm doing, is that once you ask these questions, it's like the spirit of the land just helps, intercedes, and before you know it, you're down a rabbit hole. And you kind of feel very guided, and I do feel guided in my work, even though I have to do a lot of work in the library as well to, you know, find the necessary science to give a balance to the metaphysics. I can't just say, well, I channeled all of this, even though a lot of it obviously does come from a higher source. I do back it up with as much science as I can find, and it is there. It's just that it's in very specialized fields. So I guess that's part of my job, is to bring the two sides together and come at it from a non-judgmental point of view. So I'm not offering my readers or my viewers an opinion, because the world is already stuffed with opinions. We don't need more opinions. What we need is some hardcore facts that helps us make our own mind up. And that's what I enjoy doing, is bringing both sides of the equation and removing myself out of the equation as much as possible, and providing a sense of balance. So yes, it's when we look at these small things that stand out of the ordinary that you do go down the rabbit hole. And like you said, it's the type of stone. For example, if you look at the foundation stone of the altars in Gothic cathedrals, which of course were, you know, they were built by the Cistercians and the Templars, who essentially were the same people, as I found out. Now, those altars are built on a slab of red granite. Now, red granite, there's only like 2 or 3 deposits throughout the whole of Europe where you can go and dig the stuff up. In Britain, you have to go all the way up to Iona and Mull to find red granite. So that's a long way to go to just get, you know, a 6-foot slab in order to put your altar. And it's the only piece in the entire building. And the same for Wales. The rocks have a very ringing quality to them, but they're also packed with a specific type of quartz. And it turns out it's the same quartz that was used for the first radio receivers. So there's your connection. If we talk about these places as being a communication point between us and another level of reality, well, that is the medium point that we're talking about. The stones arranged in a certain energetic location on the land, geometrically positioned, will have that kind of effect. They're creating transistors, essentially.
Now, one of the things you were talking about, your temple building, the courses you now do on that. One of the things that we have in the Christian church is the convention, frequently broken, that churches are always on an east-west alignment. And there's various reasons given in Christian theology as to why this should be. But is there a bigger, more ancient reason why they should be on an east-west alignment?
Well, the conventional view is that it favours the rising of Jesus at the equinox, and the shape of the building underlies the symbol of the crucifixion. It's absolute nonsense. Essentially, if you look back at the way that the buildings are built, it's not complete nonsense. I mean, the symbol is there, if that's how it wants to be interpreted. But the fact is that if you look at all the Gothic cathedrals, for example, they are all different. And if you build one and it's perfect, then you should just basically hand the blueprint to the next architect and it'll design exactly the same thing, cookie cutter. No, they're all different lengths, widths, and so forth, because the energy lines that they are underpinning are also different widths and heights, etc. They are actually mimicking what you can't see on the landscape. Now, I'm trying to sort of mirror this down to a couple of minutes of a soundbite, because it's a very long story. The east-west direction is a very old Celtic and pre-Celtic tradition of aligning the temple to the equinox, which is the sign of the balanced light and dark. So that's essentially the path of the ascended master or the initiate. You want to be in complete balance, not too light, not too dark, you know, not too Luke Skywalker, not too Darth Vader, just be in the middle. And that was the ultimate symbol of the risen initiate, as they call it, the risen from the dead, which is a tradition that goes back to Japan in 8,000 BC, by the way. There's nothing new in Christianity. And I think they're all plagiarizing from each other. And so the idea of having the east-west temple is a temple that forms that balance of light from rise to set. And in the ancient traditions, the baptismal fonts were placed in the east. And if you look at traditional churches in Britain, you'll still find that the baptismal room or the font is still placed in the east, whereas burials and funerals come in through the west door. Mm-hmm. Now, they're following a very ancient pagan tradition. The thing that breaks the rule is that when these buildings are not aligned to east-west and they're facing southeast or 132 degrees and so forth, that usually tells you that they're hiding the original temple that lies underneath the building. For example, Winchester Cathedral or to a certain degree Salisbury, which is also built on an original mound, which has been completely forgotten. In fact, the best part of Salisbury is actually the head of the building where the original mound used to be. But certainly Winchester is one of those buildings that is facing completely un-Christian direction. And it tells you that on that location, there used to be, I believe, a giant's grave, an enormous mound. So I think part of what happened was really goes back to the understanding that there used to be Gnostic Christianity, which was following these very old traditions and maintained. And around the time of Jesus in the Middle East, there was a sudden break. You have these people called the fundamentalists who were not much fun and they're very, very mental. And they took the understanding of the resurrection to a ludicrous understanding that somehow it was a physical description. In order not to sort of annoy people, because this is a very long, long, long story, the idea was that Jesus belonged to a very ancient tradition, like I said, that is traced back to Japan in 8,000 BC. These are people called the followers of the way. And that's essentially what the Essenes and people at Jesus' time in the Near East were following. They were following the way. Even he says that phrase. And the idea was to spend 3 years going through this initiation complex where you'd learn the bigger mysteries, you'd learn the subtle mysteries of life, know about the subtleties of nature and how to harness them. And in the third year, you'd be given a drug, you go into a box, a sarcophagus or a cave, and you leave the body. You'd have an induced near-death experience. You'd rise from the dead 3 days later, and you were greeted by Venus rising before the equinox sunrise. And that's where the church got the idea from, to build the churches aligned to the equinox sunrise. But they had no idea that the teaching was talking about a metaphor. No one gets physically nailed to a cross. That's a symbol of the risen initiate who is Christed or spiritualized, him or herself, and they are now metaphorically nailed to the cross of matter, which of course symbolizes the four earthly elements. And that created a big schism between the Gnostics and the fundamentalists. And unfortunately, the fundamentalists won. They became the Catholic Church. But so in looking at these buildings, they really didn't have the understanding of the traditional initiation practice. So they took the whole thing literally by aligning the buildings east to west.
Right.
I told you a long story.
Yeah. No. It's intriguing because, as I say, there's various explanations for it, but it just seems the easting, as it's called, it was sort of only really clarified by the Catholic Church by a cardinal sometime in the 17th century, which seems a little bit after the event.
Exactly. I mean, and again, if you, my history teacher, when I was 12, when I was living in London, he taught me one very important thing, which I've never forgotten, and I always feel bad at not having had the opportunity to go back and thank him for it. And that is, if you want to find the origin of anything, you've got to go back hundreds of years, sometimes thousands, to find the real truth of how things got to where they are today.
Yeah.
And he's absolutely right. And when I was researching the material for the subject that we're discussing right now, which is I wrote about in The Lost Art of Resurrection, I did exactly that. I mean, how old is this idea of Christianity, the crucifixion? Why do people think that some of it is actually not true? And how, let's let them speak for themselves. And I trace the story, like I said, all the way through the Middle East, all the way to the Polynesian Islands, to the Pacific, to Japan, China. It's a very ancient practice. But when people who wanted control of Europe, because at this point the Roman Empire has collapsed, there's a big vacuum of power, and a bunch of guys dressed in red robes and little red shoes wanted to control it, and they wanted to create this fictitious church. And it was a fictitious church. It has nothing to do with real Christianity. Real Christianity is much more akin to Buddhism in that respect. And everything, every single religious and spiritual movement, and I mean every single movement in the Near and Middle East at the time of Jesus, they all agreed on one thing, that the church had basically usurped the story of a real man to turn it into a false religion. And I thought that's interesting because these people don't necessarily always agree either, but they will be unanimous about the fact that because some people didn't have the true understanding of the initiation, which of course was part of a secret covenant, and you had to be invited into the secret covenant, and only because they had to measure how responsible you were as an individual. And when they realized that the church fathers were not very responsible at all, that they were going to use this to subjugate people, they didn't let him in. So of course they didn't have sufficient information, and they just made this stuff up as best as they could. That's why it doesn't quite ring true. But when you read true Christianity and Gnostic Christianity, you'll see that there's a much richer vein that connects with many spiritual concepts around the world, which are still true to this very day.
I mean, I think that even if you don't accept some of the other things you're saying, it is quite clear that the early origins of Christianity got subverted by the papacy, as in a large institution, later empire, took it over for practical reasons, and it became a temporal power rather than a spiritual power, but it dressed the temporal power in the spiritual element. But
exactly. I mean, if you look at what was happening at the time when the church was badgering the Emperor Constantine to come up with the concept of Jesus the God, because the idea didn't actually hold up very well at the time. It was completely thrown out by everybody in the Roman world, which pretty much was everybody around the Mediterranean at the time, because this guy Jesus was not a god. He had not done anything extraordinary to be a god, that they wouldn't deify him. And Constantine was kind of dying, and he got fed up with being pestered. And he said, look, the only thing that I know is that I've been following the tradition, the spiritual tradition of this god-man called Mithra. And in the end, on his deathbed, he just basically rubs out the word Mithra and puts in Jesus, and there's the story. But if you trace Mithra all the way back to the Indus Valley in 6,500 BC, you have the story of an ordinary individual who, around Easter, the spring equinox, decides to go walk about for 9 months, discovering the mysteries of life. And then on the 21st of December, on the solstice, he takes a drug, he goes into the other world for 3 days, comes back, is described risen from the dead, and goes on to teach a religion to people and live happily ever after. So you've got to start asking yourself, hello, this story is very, very old. And in fact, there are 134 identical stories with people with different names, but the initiation concept is still the same. So, you know, Jesus was a very important person, but one of tens of thousands before him who'd actually gone through the process and become risen or resurrected in his life. And I've even found this story in the Pacific island of Fiji, if you can believe that.
I'm conscious of the time. One final bit of ancient people's ancient geometry. I always get the name wrong, Göbekli Tepe in Turkey.
Ah, Göbekli Tepe.
Göbekli Tepe, yes.
It's a tough one. In fact, that's not even its real name. Its real name is Portasar. You have to understand Armenian to understand what it means. It means the umbilical cord of Osiris, and the site is linked to Giza geodetically and also etymologically. And in fact, it was one of those moments where I just sat and looked at all the research, and this picture just drops into my head of if you draw a chord between the corner of Menkaure's pyramid on Giza Plateau and the corner of Khafre's pyramid, you actually end up at Göbekli Tepe. So the story of the name of the hill is actually giving you a geodetic marker between these two sites. And there used to be these ancient astronomers from a place called Har Anu. They were members of a tribe called the Anunnaki, who were famous astronomers in this town that still survives today in southern Turkey. And they used to go do pilgrimage to Giza from south of Göbekli Tepe. They were still there in 1300 BC, I believe, leaving votives to the sky god. So, incredible how these, if you look at the origins of words, they actually reveal so much about what they do and what they're doing on the land.
That is fascinating.
It is a fascinating world. If we just get out of the way and let the stories speak for themselves, and I suggest this to anyone, because it's a wonderful way not just to pass your time, but also improve and elevate your own perception of who you are and how you connect to all of this, because we are all connected to this story. That's why they built things with big stones, to make sure that these things would not go away until a time that they would foresee that we'd be in big trouble, which is right now. We are facing huge challenges in all forms of society and climate. And it's not ironic that we are looking at sacred sites more and more. People are going to these places. I have a waiting list of 310 people to go with me to Egypt, for God's sake. I watch these people after 2 weeks. They're not the same people when they arrived. They are changed, and they changed for the better. So I do believe this is part of a major, major plan that was conceived by people, you know, 12,000 years ago, who had the wherewithal to project themselves into the future and recognize that humans are going to go through some serious changes, and they'll need all the help they can. And we have the tools, we have the help. We just have to get out and go and play.
I think that's a wonderful note to end it on there. Freddie Silver, thank you ever so much for your time today. That was absolutely fascinating and got me thinking about lots of things. Ooh, there was that, wasn't there? And there was that. And why did they drag that great big monolith all that way 10,000 years ago for no apparent reason? And
It's good to sort of shake our perception of what we've been taught, because what we've been taught, it's not that they were lying, it's just that they were projecting a story based on available evidence, and now these people are sitting on their academic white towers and protecting the theories. But a theory is only as good as the available evidence, and new evidence comes up. We have to change the story, because the evidence is forcing us to change the story, and that's what's exciting. So I hope everybody wants to be part of this, because it will be of great benefit to you. Trust me on this, and send me an email when it happens.
I will do. Right, well, Freddie, thank you ever so much again, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Oh, likewise, and let's hope the pubs keep reopening, and I hope we can get back to Britain and have a good pint.
We're out of time, so once again, a big thank you to this week's guest, Freddie Silver. You can find everything you need to know about him, including links to all his books, on his website at www.invisibletemple.com. We've all seen those interviews with very old people, where they are asked to what they attribute their long life, and they usually say something like, not drinking and only eating plain food. So let's say a big welcome to Sister Andrée, a retired French nun who lives in a nursing home in Toulon in the south of France. Sister Andrée is Europe's oldest person, and the second oldest person in the world whose age is beyond doubt, which means there are birth certificates and official documentation to establish her age. This year she celebrated her 117th, yes, 117, birthday on the 11th of February. And last year she survived a bout of coronavirus when COVID-19 hit her nursing home and 11 residents died. This incidentally also gives Sister Andrée another claim to fame, as she is now also the oldest person known to have survived the pandemic. But let's get on to Sister Andrée's birthday party, which took place just over 2 months ago. The meal started with pâté de foie gras with hot figs, washed down with a glass of port. The main course was roasted capon with porcini mushrooms and sweet potatoes, followed, because this is France after all, with roquefort and goat cheese. Red wine was served with these courses. Finally came the dessert course, a raspberry and peach-flavoured baked Alaska served with a glass of champagne. Asked what advice she would give younger people, she said, be brave and show compassion. Ah, bless. Now it just remains for me to say, this is Charles Christian saying thank you so much for listening in. Please join me again next week for more weird tales in weird times. Until then, stay well, stay weird. Goodbye.
Black Shuck, the demon dog of East Anglia, is baying at the moon. Which means it's time for us to go. You've been listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, folklore, and the paranormal. You can keep in touch with us online at www.urbanfantasist.com, by email to urbanfantasist@icloud.com, and on Twitter at @urbanfantasist. Join us again next week for another edition of the Weird Tales radio show. Goodbye.